Blog Talk Radio.
Welcome, everybody. Seth and Sean back, Sports Page, Blog Talk Radio. I know everyone in the last couple weeks has been looking forward to the return of probably the best writer back Sports Page ever had. And Keegan Reed will be joining us to talk a little bit of hockey, albeit a little bit later than we would have probably anticipated. Since we're a few games into the season, I think he'll be joining us around 7:15. An interesting little trade happened, as probably most of us who are listening know. The New York Jets decided that 1-6, make an interesting offer, to make a trade for Percy Harvin. Trading a conditional fourth-round pick. It's an interesting move for a lot of reasons. I'll let our resident Jets expert, a little bit under the weather with a bit of the sniffles, Mr. Palmer, what are your thoughts on this?
Yeah, welcome to the show. It's good to be here. I guess it's good to be anywhere, but it's good to be here in New York this week for the Jets trade. The resident Jets expert. I don't really think anybody's a Jets expert these days because nobody knows what the hell they're doing. Let's understand, this wasn't a fourth-round pick. If Percy Harvin only plays 8 games and the Jets cut him after this year, which they would have no cap obligations after this year, he earns $10 million next year. So if they cut him before next year, they will owe a 6th-round pick, not a 4th.
That's right. Okay.
So it is a conditional, really, 6th-round pick, which may be upgraded to a 4th. And I believe the 4th is, it would be in this year's draft. Well, actually, it can't be in this year's draft if it depends on whether he's getting cut or not. So it must be in next year's draft. And it's got to be a 6 to a 4. So I see this as an 8-game tryout. That's it.
But is it a tryout for Percy Harvin? Or, I mean, part of the complaints that people have had about Geno Smith are the lack of weapons that he has had around him. The running backs are mediocre. Eric Decker, as I've said many times, is not a number one receiver. He's a decent number two. Jeremy Curley is number three. They've all been playing a position up. So the idea of bringing in Percy Harvin, if healthy, is a legitimate number one receiver. It's a tryout for Harvin, to how he kind of works into the New York mainstream. Considering apparently he's had trouble, we knew about the issues in Minnesota. Nobody knew about the issues in Seattle. Punching out Golden Tate, getting into a fist fight with Doug Baldwin. I'm not quite sure how he'll handle the New York spotlight. Or is this really a tryout? Is it a trial for him? Or is this a tryout for Geno, giving him legitimate weapons to see what he can do over the next 8 games? I don't think the expectation is he's going to lead this team to the playoffs. But I think there is an expectation that if he does not look better, he will not most likely be the starting quarterback going into the next season.
I absolutely agree. I think that's a tryout for a couple of people. I think with Rex Ryan, if he goes 8-8, so that means they go 7-1 over the next 8, does he come back? It's possible. Does John Itzik keep his job, considering in the last 2 off seasons he's done almost absolutely nothing? And there's a little known fact in the collective bargaining agreement that in a 3-year average, you have to spend 90% of the cap in cash, which means you have to spend not dead money, but real money. And the Jets were $21 million below the cap this year, so definitely not in the 90%. So this could also be a way that John Itzik is keeping that monetary, so he doesn't lose draft picks due to violating the CBA. So there's a lot of parameters going around this. I got a bigger question for you. Is Percy Harvin a number one wide receiver? Because I don't see that either.
I don't know, but he is the best. He will be the best one that the Jets can throw out there. I don't think that's much of a question. Would you rather have him or Eric Decker?
Well, am I getting it? I mean, there's
if you're
a lot
getting,
of spaces
okay.
around that. Am I getting a
okay? If you're getting a healthy, if you're getting a healthy and motivated Percy Harvin,
right? Okay. If I'm getting a healthy and motivated Percy Harvin, there's probably only 10 wide receivers, maybe 15 in the league that I'd want more.
Yeah, and Eric Decker is certainly not one of them.
No, so absolutely.
My guess is if he wants any chance of receiving a big-time contract, he will be healthy and he will magically be motivated, which may seem strange going from a Super Bowl champion to a 1-6 team. But having
Seth,
been...
Here's a bigger question for you. So everybody's lambasting the Jets for this pick, for this trade.
I'm not.
I don't know which side I fall on right now. I'm kind of interested to see how he plays against the Bills this week and what kind of usage they utilize him in, because they don't have anybody at running back either. I mean, Chris Johnson, I don't care what anybody says, Chris Johnson has lost that gear. He's done. He's a serviceable back, maybe. So here you got somebody with speed that is coming out of the backfield. Maybe they utilize him that way on the sweep. Maybe they utilize him. They'll definitely utilize him as a punt returner because nobody's been able to catch the ball this year. So the question is, if this was a trade that the Patriots made, would the same reaction be going on? Because I don't see it.
No, it wouldn't be. The Patriots, however, have kind of earned, maybe over the last 10 years, because of the record they've had, have earned the right to take shots on this. The Jets, it seems like, and you know this better than I do, whether it's bringing in Favre or Tim Tebow or whoever, have really tried to just grab the back pages of the tabloids in New York City, which kind of leads to this kind of thing. I mean, if he was going to any place else, no, it's a conditional, as you said, it's a between fourth and sixth round pick for a guy who has the talent to be an all pro wideout.
Yeah,
reasonable,
I mean,
to me.
To me, this is the same as the Patriots picking up Randy Moss in the third for a third.
Yeah, from the Raiders.
From the Raiders, a complete malcontent with the Raiders, did absolutely nothing with them. Gave up and said, you know what, we're going to take a chance. I don't see any difference than that trade to this one, except little bit more money.
Well, I do. When Moss was coming into New England, there was a structure there.
I'm talking about the trade itself. Take away the teams.
Okay.
The trade. I think this has less downside than that one did.
Yeah,
it's a sixth
it could very
round
well
versus
be.
A third round.
And your team is 1-6. You're not going any lower. Yeah,
I'm not even talking about that. I'm talking this is a no-brainer. A no-brainer trade for a sixth-round pick for eight games.
Yeah.
Or nine games.
I agree. I don't have a problem with it. I had a little bit more of a problem with them having the guts to offer this to Denver for Julius Thomas.
Yeah.
How quickly do you think Denver laughed that one out of the?
Well, considering the last thing that team needs is another wideout.
Yeah.
I mean, let's see here. Their starting three is better than anybody the Jets put on the field at first, and maybe better than anybody that the Giants put on the field too.
So I mean.
Yeah, there's no comparison. But the fact is, I think this is a good trade for the Jets short term. It could be a very good trade long term. Look, he's earning $10 million next year. Let me repeat again, he is basically on a year-to-year contract for the next 5 years. They can cut him any time and have no cap hit. So if he plays nine games this year, by the way, that would be one more game than he played for Seattle in 2 years, because he only played eight for them, including the Super Bowl. And he comes into a comfortability factor with the Jets, and they play him for one more year at $10 million, and then he goes off and he does his shtick. They cut him. They got a number one wide receiver for $17 million for 2 years. That's what a number one receiver costs.
Yeah.
I don't really see, again, I don't see the downside. Even if it's a fourth-round pick, if it's a fourth-round pick, there's a reason it's a fourth-round pick. I love conditional trades. for that reason. It all depends on how he performs. So an eight-game, let me put it this way. The Jets cut a fourth-round pick from this year already. Another one of their fourth-rounders is on IR, and the third one isn't doing anything. So if this is a fourth-round pick, he's no better than half the Jets' picks anyway. No worse. I'm okay with it. I really like it. Actually, I like the trade itself. Okay, so let's go on to what happened in the NFL this week. Let's start with the ascension and descension of one Kirk Cousins.
Well, when it was good, it was pretty damn good. But it wasn't good for very long. And when it was bad, it was ugly. And, you know, the discussion that he could become Matt Schaub, you know, eventually be traded for a second-round pick, that's gone by the wayside. Colt McCoy will be starting next week, most likely, over Robert Griffin III. Is probably
They already announced it. He will be starting. Absolutely.
Oh, it's not RG3?
No.
Well, you know, Cousins, this was his chance. This was his opportunity. Now, unlike Geno in New York, you look at the weapons that Washington has. You have Pierre Garçon. You have DeSean Jackson. You have Jordan Reed, the tight end, Jordan Reed. You pick up Andre Roberts. You have Alfred Morris. That is a good offense. Not a great offensive line, but that is some good talent. And, you know, there's really not much to say. He had a chance with a reasonable offensive line, not against an outrageously hard schedule. I mean, he played, I think, Seattle early, and that's always tough. But the last couple of games have not been outrageously difficult teams defensively. The Cardinals were not a great pass defense, surprisingly, this year. The Giants were not great. Tennessee is not great at anything. And he's in deep trouble. And actually, before we get on to the NFL, we are quite happy to bring on, for the first time in, I guess, about 6 months, probably the best writer in the history of Back Sports Page, Mr. Keegan Reed. How are you doing, sir?
Wow, that's a great entrance. I hope I can live up to that. I'm doing well, thanks. How are you?
I'm doing well. Sean?
I was going to play some Pomp and Circumstance.
Oh, for God's sakes.
For Sir Keegan is back.
Okay. Have you play your Pomp and Circumstance.
No, I'm okay.
I was going to say, I feel like it's a WWE.
Dun, 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 dun,
okay.
Dun, dun,
yeah. Okay. You're done. All right. So we've been trying to get you on the last couple of weeks. We're trying to do more of a preseason preview, but now we're a week in. You know, Sean is in ecstasy because while his Jets are struggling and his Mets are going nowhere and his Syracuse football isn't very good, his Islanders are 4-1.
It is a beautiful time right now to be a New York Islanders fan.
Words not said very often over your lifetime, Keegan.
No, you know what? As a matter of fact, I think the year I was born was probably the last time it was okay to say that out loud.
Was that 84? 85?
No,
94.
No.
The end of the drive for five.
Wait. 92, we went to the conference finals against Montreal.
Yeah,
that's right. That's when you beat Pittsburgh.
Yeah,
in game David seven Volek. On an overtime goal by David Volek. I remember.
David Volek.
But
that was a pretty good.
You're absolutely right.
But for the first time in a long time, I can say that honestly, the Islanders' talent base looks like they're going to be poised to be in a good position for a long time coming. And it really looks like management has finally got their system for tracking down free agents and making trades. It looks like they're really building a solid core that they can build around for a number of years.
From your words to God's ears. Because, man, it's been a rough ride for the last 20 years, I got to tell you. But
you look at this offseason, bringing in Jaroslav Halak, who we saw during stretches in St. Louis, and we certainly saw during a miraculous playoff run here in Montreal. He plays his best hockey when he's seeing a lot of pucks come his way, and with a young hockey team in front of him, he's going to get exactly that. Plus, you get those moves on the blue line. I think Johnny Boychuk may be one of the single most underrated pickup of the offseason. You look at what he's doing numbers-wise, but it's also the leadership and the grit that a guy who's been with a team like the Bruins for so many years can bring to a young locker room. I think that's going to be a key acquisition moving forward.
Well, that actually brings up a question. Why was he traded? This was someone, I mean, this was a trade that caught a lot around here by surprise, as someone, you know, a pretty solid contributor for Boston. Was it just a contract issue with free agents coming up?
You know what, I personally think it probably was. When you look at the Boston Bruins right now, they're sort of paying that hangover price for making those Stanley Cup runs. They're a team that they had to watch Jerome Iginla walk out the door, a player that they desperately wanted to have in their room and a player who wanted to be a Boston Bruin. And I think Johnny Boychuk was caught in the same position. Boston had to pay their young guys. They had to keep guys like Brad Marchand under contract. They've got guys like Riley stepping up. Tuukka Rask was well long overdue for a big pay upgrade. The fact of the matter is, if you want to play in the salary cap era and make a run 2-3 years in a row deep into the playoffs, there's a good chance you're going to be mortgaging your future to do so. And it came time to pay the piper, and that's why I think you're seeing an exodus of talent from Boston this season.
Yeah, and you're gonna see that in a couple of years. Well, this year or next year, you've already started in Chicago with Nick Leddy as well. And I think that the two acquisitions of those two defensemen has totally solidified the defensive core. And I wouldn't look past the backup goalie either. I mean, the Islanders haven't had good goaltending since, I believe, Glenn Healy, if you really want to go all the way back to that. So here we are with two goalies which you can count on getting a 90% or better percentage. The one thing that they don't have, and I saw this against Pittsburgh, is I don't have the confidence in this team to actually come back. So if they have a lead and they give it up, they don't have the firepower to get back into a game. So
that's a fair assessment. But when you look at a team that's early in the curve, like they are, that comes with character. That comes with experience. I think the Islanders are definitely going to be a playoff team this year. And I think that when you get 2-3 seasons in a row like that, you'll start to see the big moment guys step up. You've got a couple of real grinders in the system there, and guys like Casey Cizikas, Cal Clutterbuck. These are guys who maybe fly a little bit under the radar, especially with John Tavares in town, you know, anchoring that big top line with Okposo. But there are some younger guys in there that are going to be that sandpaper moving forward. I think you're going to be pleasantly surprised as the season goes on, watching those Islanders closely.
Well, I hope so. Well, here's the big ticket question. How many of the New York hockey teams of the three will make the playoffs this year?
Two. I've got the Islanders and the Rangers both coming out of the Metropolitan Division. I feel like the Rangers maybe overachieved a little bit last year. They're just a little bit weak down the left side, in my opinion. But honestly, the Eastern Conference is the weaker of the two conferences, and a team that goes that deep one year is simply not going to fall off the map. They're a good, solid hockey team who maybe went a little bit further than fate should have let them last season.
Okay, well, let's go north to the border. Let's go north to the border to the Toronto Maple Leafs. In or out?
I've got them sitting outside the playoff picture. To be honest, I just don't see the consistency. They've got a few bright spots. They're doing okay. The goaltending is middle of the road at best for Toronto, and their defense is slow. I mean, there's just not a lot of foot speed back there, and in today's NHL, you need to be able to get that puck out of your end quickly. It's all about the counter game right now, and Toronto just gets caught flat-footed a lot. They give up a ton of shots. And even in the Eastern Conference, you're hard-pressed to get away with that.
Well, the last few years, there's been obviously a definitive difference between conferences. But usually this is a cyclical thing. Now, I mean, when I look at the West, I still see Chicago as a heavyweight. The Kings are obviously a heavyweight. You still have San Jose, who, you know, I forget the comparison who I made them to. but Sean made fun of me because I actually used a good hockey reference, hockey metaphor for a change. But, you know, there's a team that just never got to that place. At some point, you know, St. Louis is going to be right there. At some point, there has to be a transition where the East starts to come up a little bit. Is this the year where this happens? Because it doesn't feel like it. With Boston taking probably a small step back, what do you have?
Well, to be honest with you, I think it's a very acute observation. I think you could probably make the argument that there are maybe five or upwards of six teams in the Western Conference that are better than the best team in the Eastern Conference. You mentioned some of those big names, Chicago, L.A., Anaheim is very good. Nashville is phenomenal on paper this year. I can't wait to see what they accomplish over the run of the regular season. But in the East, listen, you've got a lot of talent stockpiled. You've got a lot of young talent that's been reaped from those years of being essentially subpar and getting those solid draft picks. You're seeing teams right now, you look at Tampa, pops to head instantly about a team that's just stacked with young talent and on the uptick for certain. You get guys like Steven Stamkos there, obviously, but Jonathan Drouin is coming into the lineup. Victor Hedman, who I had penciled in as a Norris Trophy favorite up until breaking his wrist 2 days ago. There's a lot of young talent coming up. I think, you know, maybe I'm being a bit of a homer, as I tend to be, but if you look at the Montreal Canadiens right now, shipping out Brian Gionta, shipping out Josh Georges in the offseason, they're handing the keys of the car right now to P.K. Subban and guys like Brendan Gallagher and saying to the young guns, you know what, let's run with it. You'll see it a little bit, but the problem is in the East, that's where the real basement dwellers dwell also. Teams like Buffalo and New Jersey, they've got a long road ahead of them. Philadelphia's on a downfall right now. You know, parity's hard to come by right now. It really is. There are a few teams on the uptick in the East, but overall, I think I agree with your assessment. It may be a few more years until we see any real balance.
Sean, I would just like...
Let's
Sean.
Just understand that Seth made a very valid point in hockey.
for the
second time in like 3 weeks, which, man... If I do that on the college basketball preview, he'll have to give me credit back.
Yeah, I just want on tape that that Keegan stated I made an astute hockey observation. I just want to make sure that you heard that, Sean.
Well, there's one, you know, it happens once a year, so there you go. You got it.
So
Keegan, you've spoken to the South. In Tampa, but there's a team there are a couple of teams to me that are just flailing. Like, they're going downhill, and there's nowhere for them to go but up, and that's Carolina and Florida. I don't see where these teams seem to be some of those bottom dwellers, but really don't have any hopes for coming up.
Yeah, you know what's funny? I look at my notes here in front of me, and the first bold lettering in front of Carolina is they're in for a world of hurt this season. And it really comes down to that, especially with Jordan Staal going out. They're essentially a one-line team with no defense and question marks in goal. It's going to be a long time coming, and unfortunately, I think that those glory days of, you know, carrying the Hartford Whalers remnants in and making that Stanley Cup run are long gone. In Florida, you have a little bit of a different situation. Roberto Luongo ended up there in the offseason where he started his career, where he played his best hockey, some would argue. Number one overall pick, Aaron Ekblad. Guys like Jonathan Huberdeau, Andre Barkov. There's a lot of young talent in Florida, and right now they're sort of pieced together with a lot of journeyman talent as well. When I look at the Florida Panthers, I essentially see three second lines, no first line, no third line. They're a team that could get hot at any given moment. I know they had a miracle run to the playoffs the year before last. It's going to take a little bit of time for that youth to develop, but they're one of the teams who I think 3-4 years from now are going to be very happy with the way they've drafted and very happy with the way they've replenished their system with youth. Carolina, I completely agree with you. I honestly see them floundering for a long time coming.
But will Luongo be there in 4 or 5 years? I mean, he's no spring chicken.
No, he's no spring chicken. That's true. But you know what? When you look at the ability of goaltenders to last a long time, you look at somebody like Marty Brodeur, who plays that quick style, who doesn't end up taking a lot of injuries over the course of a career. These guys are very effective up into the ages of 38, 39, even 40 years old for some goaltenders. Luongo's always been a healthy player over the course of his career, and he has a notorious fitness regimen. I wouldn't be surprised to see him playing quality hockey. Again, particularly in a division that isn't that strong, he could be that backbone for another 5 or 6 seasons, long enough for that youth to develop.
Fair enough. Fair enough. So we've covered some of the North. We've covered the tri-state area. We've covered north of the border. But the state of Pennsylvania we haven't covered yet, and there's two very interesting teams. The Flyers, who seem to be in their never-ending search for a backliner, and with Kimmo Timonen out again, and Chris Pronger now in the NHL office, still looking for that type of deal. And then you have the Penguins, who have a new coach, a new general manager, who used to be the general manager of the floundering Carolina Hurricanes. Are they going in different directions, or is Philly going to make the playoffs this year?
Well, I don't think Philadelphia is going to make the playoffs this year, straight off the cuff. I just don't see any reason to believe that the ghosts from the seasons past have gone. They always seem to be chasing that one more player. Last year it was Vincent LeCavalier. He came in, didn't really make much of a difference. They have no defensemen, like you mentioned. They've got Steve Mason and Ray Emery between the pipes, who I think are both projects who may turn out. I mean, at best. Steve Mason had one season in Columbus where he looked all right before ending up in Philadelphia. Ray Emery made one good run with the Ottawa Senators, but that was the better part of a decade ago now.
I was going to say, I really wouldn't call them prospects at this point. Now, these guys have been around for a pretty long period of time. I don't know how the expectation could be very high.
Well, no, I may have misspoke. I meant to say project, if I did say prospect. It's something they're hoping works out. It's something they've got their goaltending coaches working on. Both goaltenders are capable of putting together 3, 4, 5 games where they look like elite goaltending talent. But over the course of 82 games, I don't see either one of them really being in a position to make a legitimate stand for a legitimate playoff contender.
These Flyers seem to remind me of the New York Yankees right now. They have a lot of very, very good talent that's in their high talent pool. But they don't have a lot of cap room, and they don't have a lot of youngsters coming up to push that talent up.
And that's essentially been the situation that the Flyers have found themselves in for the last 3 or 4 years. I mean, they get away with a lot because of the talent of Claude Giroux and because of his elite superstar status. Wayne Simmons is a good hockey player. Jakub Voracek is a good hockey player. But they don't have the superstars to run and gun. And let's face it, if you're going to come out of the East, you have to be able to outgun the likes of Sidney Crosby and Evgeny Malkin. That's what it's going to take to win the Eastern Conference, or you're going to have to be a solid top-to-bottom defensive team. I don't think the Philadelphia Flyers are either one of those, and I don't think that they're moving in either of those directions. They're one of those teams that tends to be, when I look at them, I think they're treading water. They're going to hang on, maybe challenge for a wild card spot, finish in that dead man's zone of 7 to 11 in the rankings where they don't quite make a push, but they don't quite get a great draft pick either.
Now, you spoke about Nashville and that you were excited about them. Why so excited about Nashville this year?
Well, I mean, you look at Nashville, I think first and foremost, they're a team that Barry Trotz built, cultivated a very defensive-minded culture. Now, of course, he's moved on to Washington, and you've got Peter Laviolette behind the bench, and you've got a lot of talent for him to work with. So when you have a team that's been sort of very good, very consistent over the last 5 or 6 years, but has been a little bit pent up offensively from playing that tight system, you bring in a guy who's a little more prone to take a run-and-gun approach like Peter Laviolette, and you've got a team that could seriously threaten. Very, very deep up front. Another team who I look at as sort of having one top line and then 2 or 3 three even second lines to roll up behind it. They've got guys like Paul Gostad rolling in their bottom line right now, and he's a second-line player in half the teams in the NHL. So when you stack that with an incredibly deep defensive pool and a goaltender in Pekka Rinne who is consistently in the running for the Vezina, I really think that last year's performance where Nashville sort of slipped out of the picture is going to be the anomaly looking back. They're a team that system-wise, personnel-wise, is built for the playoffs, and they're in a division right now where they could seriously do some damage. Colorado isn't as good as they looked last year.
Well, so speaking of teams that have struggled, you mentioned Buffalo and Carolina. Going into the season, you know, are there teams in the West, you know, teams that come to mind, although Calgary's off to a pretty decent start, but a Calgary, a Winnipeg, and Edmonton, kind of that, well, Northwest Canadian triad, that could really threaten Buffalo or Carolina to try and get Connor McDavid?
Hey, you know, Keegan, before you say something, that's Seth's second good point of the hockey. You don't even know who Connor McDavid is.
I've known who Connor McDavid is for a couple of years. He's been out there for a while.
Okay.
Yeah, his name
and
has
you
been
know
on
who
the
update. Second guy is? The guy that may be competing with McDavid?
Don't push it.
Okay. Continue.
So anyway.
Well, if you want to look at the bottom of that pile, I would have before the season said that Calgary, you're right, would have been in that breath. Seeing what I've seen from some of their players, the likes of Johnny Gaudreau stepping up, Sean Monahan, I had a chance to see play some junior hockey. He played in Ottawa, which is only 2 hours away from here. And he is a solid two-way player, the kind of guy who can make the jump to the NHL and make an impact very young. And I think you're seeing Calgary is actually developing a little bit of character on their team. They're developing an identity that maybe a team like, let's say, the Edmonton Oilers simply doesn't have. But what Edmonton does have is a stockpile of high-end talent. We've all been sort of holding our breath for the last 3 years, waiting for that talent to mature. I don't think this is going to be the year, but I do think there's a future there. There's enough talent there to really rattle the cage a little bit, make some noise. I don't think they're going to be basement dwellers. But Winnipeg, unfortunately, I think they are also dead in the water. I mean, they have one offensive player worth mentioning. He's injured right now, and when he's not injured, he wants a trade. There's
so
just
let's
nothing
pick up
there
the
to build
little
around.
Preview here and go to who is the first superstar, Keegan, the first star that you believe will be traded this year? Will he be out of Edmonton? Will it be the enigmatic center out of Edmonton?
You know what? It could be Edmonton getting desperate. They need some veteran talent. They could easily flip some of that youth for one or two guys, maybe two guys who could fit into their roster right now and a prospect. That would probably be in their best interest, but I think Edmonton will end up waiting to see whether or not they need to move on a goaltender. Because right now you've got Ben Scrivens and Victor Fast, who are both potential number ones in the NHL in the next year and a half, 2 years, but really both have a lot of question marks surrounding them. I would actually, and this is a long shot, this is one you're not going to hear from a lot of other hockey guys, I would look at, particularly in Pittsburgh right now, as you mentioned, the new GM, Jimmy Rutherford, is there. I think that if things turn south in Pittsburgh, either in goaltending, in terms of goaltending with Marc-Andre Fleury, who's been streaky at best for the last few years, or in terms of getting some depth production from their defensemen, you might see Evgeny Malkin on the move. It's a move that I've been saying has made sense for the last 2-3 years. You simply cannot let two dogs the size of Crosby and Malkin eat and expect for there to be enough left over for anybody else. Malkin is a guy who deserves the minutes on a number one line, and he's never going to get it sitting behind Crosby. And
now,
if you look, you don't even have to leave the organization to go back 20 years to say, look, Jaromir Jagr was a fantastic player on the same team as Mario Lemieux. But we didn't see the real Jaromir Jagr until Lemieux was gone from Pittsburgh, and then eventually when Jagr moved on and to his 17 NHL teams he played for afterwards.
So you're looking at Gino being traded, an interesting move considering they probably can't get a lot for Letang, considering his seizure problems. They're certainly not trading Crosby. They've already traded Neal. They've already traded Staal. and they have $9.5 million wrapped up in Geno over the next 5 years in his contract. Where could he go, and who could absorb the hit? Because I know the Islanders could absorb the hit, but I don't think the Islanders would make that trade because of what Pittsburgh would want. Who has enough that could do it?
You would need a team with a lot of youth in the system, or a team that we could at least bang some of that salary back the other direction. I would look at, and this is, it seems that it, this is the one team that always comes up when there's that one player, because they always seem to put themselves in a perfect position where if they need somebody, they can go get them. And I would look at the Detroit Red Wings. They're notorious for drafting very well. They have got a lot of youth and depth in their system right now. You look at guys coming up through the system, guys like Tatar, Nyquist, Justin Abdelkader. They find these guys late in draft, and they develop them into quality NHL talent, exactly the kind of second-tier talent that Crosby's been lacking. There is no third and fourth line in Pittsburgh over the last few years, not since Jordan Staal left. And I think that if you were to move Malkin, that's exactly what you'd be hoping to get back in return, unless Fleury were to falter, and then you could go out and maybe pursue a number one goaltender. But that's a maybe situation.
Yeah, I'm looking right now at the cap room for – so you would pay – so Gina would go above Datsyuk and above Zetterberg, right? So he'd be the highest paid player by far, over $1 million more.
Oh, he sure would be. And, you know, Pittsburgh may have to eat some of that salary coming back. It's a complicated mathematical game right now.
Yeah, $65 million, 63 on the cap payroll. I think their cap number is about 68 right now. So, yeah, so I get it. I totally get it. And Datsyuk is on one of those 35 pluses. And I'll tell you, Gino would love to play with Datsyuk and Zetterberg. I mean, that's ideal for him. But then
and especially
you have,
staying in the Eastern Conference, that would be terrifying to see for if you're an opposing
exactly.
team.
But does the same dilemma happen in Detroit that you now have in Pittsburgh?
Well,
because
the thing about Detroit,
you have two number one centers.
The problem with Detroit is, or the thing about Detroit is, these guys tend to drink the Kool-Aid. And when I talk about the system, you get guys like Brett Hull willing to go there late in their career. And if you can talk Brett Hull out of getting the puck on a one-time feed in that left-hand side, I'm pretty sure that system will work for just about anybody. You know, you had guys, Mike Modano made his final appearance in the NHL doing his victory tour around Detroit. Just Daniel Alfredson is currently there. For the chance to go there and trust in an organization like that, I think you can spread it around just a little bit more. And to be honest with you, I wouldn't be surprised if one of those names had to come back in a deal that saw Malkin moving that direction. So there may only be one or two of them looking to eat.
Well, that would be a huge deal if either Datsyuk or Zetterberg went back.
It would be, but if you talk about a trade that works for both teams, and again, I'm pulling straws. You're asking me, you know, six games into a season, who's getting traded? This is what I'm looking at.
Sean,
I'm looking at if I'm going to hit the home run if I'm going to swing.
Maybe
there
you
go.
What? Maybe
Sean never puts pressure on. Sean never puts pressure on people on a radio show, so don't worry about it.
You know what, Keegan? Maybe I was just hoping that you'd say he'd wind up in Brooklyn. And we give up a guy in Tavares and move over to the right side. Maybe I was just.
I would rather if I were a fan of the New York Islanders right now, I would rather be patient than make that move. I really would. With the amount of talent that's in there, like I said, Tavares, Okposo, Grabner, Cizikas, Clutterbuck, Josh Bailey, that there's depth and serious depth at a very young age. There's no need to mortgage the future right now.
Fair enough.
In a weak Eastern Conference, as you said. And I'm almost laughing as I say this. In their last season in the ugliest arena in the history of sports, which it is, having been there last year, do the Islanders have a chance at making the Cup Finals?
Yes. They have the same puncher's chance that anybody in the East has. I think right now, if you look at the East, you're going to end up with 80% of the people you talk to are going to have Pittsburgh sitting atop their favorite status. Montreal is very good right now. There's a lot of depth and a lot of speed, but again, I think they're probably 2 years away from realizing the full potential. They could make a run this year. And other than that, you've got Boston, who, as I already said, is on the wrong side of that peak. They're on their way down. Those are the three top teams in the East as I see it. But then you've got teams like Detroit, the Islanders, the Rangers, Tampa, and I would even say Washington right now with this Barry Trotz defensive system being implemented. Those are the teams that are knocking down the door, and any one of them realistically could make a run to the Cup final. As we saw with the Rangers last year, they're a good team, but I don't think they were that good. But they got hot at exactly the right moment. When you've got the right goaltender, anything can happen.
All right, so Keegan, who's coming out of the East?
I've got Montreal and Pittsburgh playing in the Eastern Final, and I just don't trust Marc-Andre Fleury, and I do think that Carey Price is due. So I think if Carey Price was not hurt last year, the Habs would have made the Cup Final. I think this year he stays healthy. They come out of the East.
And which are the teams that don't make the playoffs?
Oh, in the East, I've got New Jersey sitting outside of a playoff spot. I've got Philly sitting out. Columbus, but just barely. I think they're a team that's going to be knocking on the door again, sneaky deep. They've made some key off-season moves that have really flown under the radar. Buffalo won't make it. Florida won't make it. And then you've got Ottawa and Toronto, I think, both sitting outside. Teams that just aren't ready yet.
Well, Canada's not a happy place to be because if you look at the West, I think you're going to have a similar concept, right?
Yeah, that's about right. I've got Vancouver as the only Canadian team in the playoffs out West, and that's based on a lot of optimism. I mean, we're seeing the Sedins playing some very good hockey right now under new coach Willie Desjardins, and he's really opened up the offense. So if they can get running and gunning, and if Ryan Miller can prove that he's the same goaltender he was 3 or 4 years ago, Vancouver's got a real good chance out there in the West.
So who do you have coming out of the West?
Well, you know what? The Stanley Cup's going to be won in an odd year, so it's Chicago's turn. But you could flip a coin between Chicago and LA.
I was going to say,
they are the class of the National Hockey League.
Have you ever seen in any sport, maybe Dallas and the Niners in the early 90s, where you have two teams that are almost competing to see who's the dynasty? And that's really what you have with Chicago and the Kings right now. The Kings have had two in the last 3 years.
Really,
Chicago's had two in the last 4 years. They played each other in that great, seven-game series last year. It's very strange.
It's a shame to hockey fans that they can't play each other for the Cup. Because honestly, as I mentioned before, you could look at Chicago, Los Angeles, Nashville, St. Louis, Anaheim as all being better than the best team in the East.
Yep.
And it's a shame the way the seeding works out.
Seth, disappointed with you. I think the last time that you could say that there were two dynasties competing would have been your New Jersey Devils and the Detroit Red Wings.
That's a fair assessment. New Jersey was
that
knocking
fair.
On the door. New Jersey had that Carolina Hurricanes complex, though, where they would either be eighth place or first place, and that was it. They were took a few seasons off in the early 2000s, despite the fact that they took all those miracle runs as well.
But they were not competing in the same conference.
Correct.
Remember at that point, Detroit
was
in the West.
They were battling it out before they got to the Cup final.
Detroit, I mean, the Devils actually won their first Cup over Detroit in the sweep in '95. So they weren't competing. They weren't competing to get to the Cup. They were competing at the Cup level. So
no, I was talking about competing. The dynasty. I was talking about competing for a dynasty.
Okay, but so who do you have as the MVP? Is this going to be the typical Sidney Crosby, and we can just kind of close the book on it, or are we going to see a John Tavares or a Ryan Getzlaf or someone along those lines this year?
Well, I think you had it with your second pick there. I think Sidney Crosby is probably going to have the better season, but I think if you look at the talents around him and where the expectation level is for the Pittsburgh Penguins, the NHL is very unique, and it has this concept of the player who's most valuable to his team. And I think that if you look at what the Islanders have done on the upswing over the last 3-4 seasons and the fact that Tavares is poised to have a monster breakout season, I think you're going to find that he will be, in fact, much more valuable to his team. Because we've seen the Penguins make the playoffs without Crosby. Malkin is more than capable of shouldering that load. If you take Tavares off the Islanders, they become a very different franchise.
Well, you saw that last year, right, Keegan? I mean, when he got hurt, the team went in the tank. The last time
absolutely.
That the
and I don't think he's going to get hurt this year. I think he's going to make a long run. I mean, you see him right now. I think he's sitting atop. I think he may even be tied with Crosby for the scoring lead through six or seven games.
And Brock Nelson is a tremendous find. The fact is, the last time that the Islanders had a winner of any award might have been Pierre Turgeon as the Lady Bing. I mean, it's been 20 years. You just had me doing a jig around the apartment.
Well, I think it's a legitimate thing. And you know what? I've also got him as my first pick on my fantasy team, so I'm pulling a stroke maybe a little. But you know what? I took him well ahead of his ranking. I took him with the number 3 overall pick because I honestly do believe in my gut that he is poised for a big, big season.
Does Carey Price take the Vezina? You think Montreal is probably going to the finals. And it's going to be based on
In order for them to fulfill that, it certainly has to be on the back of Carey Price. They've got a defensive core that is deep and very good, but outside of P.K. Subban, no superstar defenseman. And even with P.K., he's a little bit of a defensive liability still. I know he's come a long way. He's got the Norris under his belt. But I think the Vezina's going to come down to Carey Price and John Quick. But if you look at, again, the one who's the player between the two who's more valuable to his team, the Montreal Canadiens are much more reliant on the success of Carey Price than the Kings are on Jonathan Quick. Daryl Sutter has the Kings playing a phenomenal defensive system where, honestly, if you put me in goal, I could probably get out of there with the goals against under 5. He's fantastic, and he will continue to be fantastic. But I just think, based on how much his team needs him, this will be Carey Price's year.
All right.
So one more award that we haven't talked about is the Calder Trophy, which is Rookie of the Year. Does that go to the guy down in Tampa?
Well, you know what? I think under normal circumstances it would. But I think there's going to be a little bit of a loophole, a little bit of a technicality that decides the fate of the Calder Trophy this year. I think if you look out in Los Angeles, you'll see a kid on the roster by the name of Tanner Pearson, who, in order to qualify as an NHL season, a player must play 26 games. Pearson played 25 last season and then the entirety of the playoffs and went on to win a Stanley Cup. Now, if you take a look at the top 20, 25 scorers in the National Hockey League right now, only one of those guys is a +5 or better, and that is Tanner Pearson. And you look at the average ice time, it is by far the lowest of any guy in the top 20 in scoring right now. So you got a guy who's got a ton of experience. He's got, at this point, a 6 or 7 game head start because Drouin, of course, is still coming back off of the broken thumb. And he's playing on a team that is playoff ready. He's playing on a team right now. I mean, I think Jeff Carter is centering his line. You're not going to get that with most rookies. So I think Tanner Pearson is going to have the better season. Now, if you ask me 2 years from now which rookie would I rather have on my team, I'll take Jonathan Drouin's career any day of the week. But if you're talking purely about this season, I think the Calder Trophy is Tanner Pearson's to lose.
Fair enough.
So, well, actually,
the
last question. Well, we have Montreal in the East, and we know we're looking at Chicago or L.A. probably in the West. And whoever's going to win that is probably going to cruise to the Cup. Who do you got?
Oh, it's going to be Chicago. I have no disillusions about where the better talent lies. I think Montreal has what it takes to win the East, but I still think that regardless, whoever comes out of the West is going to be the favorite. You could take your pick of one of 4 teams, and they're going to be favored in that series.
Fantastic.
Ladies and gentlemen,
always, Keegan. Thank you very much for joining us.
Keegan, hopefully we'll have you around mid-season so we can kind of run this through again and have, once again, Sean be in awe of my overall hockey knowledge.
Well, you know what? You put me in awe of your overall hockey knowledge this evening, so
I'm
impressed by your research capacity.
There you go.
Keegan Reid, everybody.
Thanks a lot
so much
for having me, guys. You guys have a great
night. Thank you very
much,
sir.
It's always a pleasure.
Have a
great day. Bye-bye.
So as you can tell, for people who have listened to the show over the last couple of years, Keegan is, I should have probably made some comments about the Falcons because he is a huge Atlanta Falcons fan and that's just looking ugly. But one of our favorite people ever to be associated with Back Sports Page, and truly as knowledgeable about hockey as anyone I've ever met. in both the media and just from a fan level. I was waiting for the reaction when he said that Tavares was his pick for the MVP. I can see the smile on your face, which my guess would be, you probably haven't had a smile that big sports related since Hakeem Warrick blocked Michael Lee in 2003.
It's been a while, but I have to tell you, it's been nice watching the Islanders. It really has. It's become, I won't say it's become must-see television, but if they're on and I'm home, it's on. Over any other sport, it's on. So we only got about 10 minutes left. So why don't we quickly talk about the Notre Dame Florida State fiasco and
now,
some pass interference that happened.
Now, why do you consider this a fiasco?
Well, A, it was within 5 yards.
This to me was, I thought this was legitimately the right call. It's an ugly call because it's not something you really want to see a game decided by. But do you think it was a wrong call? It was a bad call?
No, I don't think it's a wrong call. I just think it was, look, I think that call goes on all the time. I think they called it at that point. Do I think it was the wrong call? No. When I saw it, I was like, yeah, that's the right call. I think it's a fiasco because look when it happened, where it happened, and how it happened. So it's a fiasco in that realm. But I think it was the right call. I think they made their point, and Florida State moves on. And Mississippi State's still number one.
Yeah. It's college football, it's been a heck of a year so far in college football, and we've talked about it, and we'll continue to discuss it more after our previews. We have the NBA next week. I will actually not be here in 2 weeks, so we may have to push college basketball to the second week in November.
Okay.
But, yeah, you have some crazy endings. Oklahoma losing on missing a 19-yard field goal by the Big 12's all-time leading kicker, or he will be by the time he retires. Baylor loses to West Virginia by 14. That actually makes Maryland's loss to West Virginia by 3 at the buzzer look pretty good. It's a fun year. And college football, to me, is the most fun sport there is to watch. And while we may have Florida State is cruising in the ACC now, we have 4 in the top 5 from the SEC West. I mean, how do you even incomprehensible?
Well, we know that can't last, right? I mean,
they're
going to play each other.
So you're looking at some great games coming up. You have Mississippi in Auburn. You're going to have Mississippi State in Alabama. Of course, you're going to have Mississippi in Mississippi State. And you figure at least 2 of these are going to fall by the wayside. Alabama looked awesome, beating A&M, Texas A&M 59-0. And I kind of wonder what this is doing to Kevin Sumlin's reputation. This was a man who was pretty much interviewed at any place he wanted after last year. And after the first game where they destroyed a top 10 preseason top 10 South Carolina, you thought this was something that was going to continue, but they had been awful in the last month. They've been beaten convincingly by Mississippi State, and 59-0 by Alabama. Oof. So,
well, but losing to Alabama, granted that score is a little bit ridiculous. Losing to Alabama is really not a knock, is it?
No,
I mean, granted,
but losing 59-0 is.
Well, yeah. I mean, like I said, the score is a little bit ridiculous. But, I mean, Alabama is the top school, and A&M, after losing Johnny Manziel, is not. It's that simple. I mean.
Yeah. Well, one of the
best part is Florida State didn't beat Syracuse by that score. Yay!
No, they did not. No, they did not. And, you know, I do wonder, though, if the other team in Florida, how many games Will Muschamp has left to coach in Florida?
Well, there was a great graphic on ESPN that said, I think that Florida gave up under 120 yards total offense this week and still lost. In the last 20 years, There have been 127 games in which a team has given up under 120 yards total offense. Everybody else is 120-0, and Munchap is 0-2.
But not only did they lose that game, and you're right, I believe they let up a fumble recovery, an interception recovery, a punt return, and a kick return. They had 6 turnovers. They lost by 29 on homecoming to Missouri. This is not last year's Missouri team. This is bad. Muschamp, this team is 25-19 under Muschamp. I don't think there's a chance he can keep this job.
No.
It's just going to be a question of who gets fired first, him or Brady Hoke. And those are two very, very big jobs that will be out there for the taking for whoever it is, whether it's Dan Mullen going back to Florida from Mississippi State, whether it's Les Miles coming from LSU up to Michigan. But what would be really interesting is if neither of those two come into play, if for some reason they decide to stay where they are respectively, then you have an absolute free fall for those jobs.
Or Jim Harbaugh.
Yeah, well, after what happened, and we should give a shout-out to Peyton Manning for breaking the all-time touchdowns record, touchdown passes in a career, breaking Brett Favre last night in a – I guess this is nice. Now, I was at a wedding, so I missed most of the game. But I believe the correct word is annihilation.
Yeah.
42-10. I think that works well.
Yeah.
We only got 2 or 3 minutes left. Is there anything that we really need to hit on the NFL, or is it –
Nope.
Any real scores, or we just kind of go to our little finale?
No, we're good to go. I mean, I think as far as the finale, I'll go first. There were two impressive things that happened in the last couple of days. Number one, you want to know the reason that James Shields did not pitch game 4 of the ALCS? He had a kidney stone.
Ooh.
He pitched in the ALCS with a kidney stone. My God, man. He passed the kidney stone during the ACLS. My God. From a guy that had kidney stones in July, there is no greater pain in my entire life than a kidney stone. I had heard it before, and now I have felt it. My God. Okay. Number two, we have to make our World Series predictions because they start tomorrow. I am taking the Royals in 6.
And I am going to take the Royals in 7.
Okay.
Just because, you know what? I just would like to. I don't know. I think these teams are very even. I don't see any real major advantages. And maybe I'm wrong. I mean, Kansas City's bullpen's a little bit better. Buster Posey's still the best player in the series. Baumgartner may be the best pitcher in the series over Shields. It just kind of feels like Kansas City's time. And I think it's very easy to root for a team that hasn't made a playoff in 31 years, or in 29 years, excuse me, and to see them win 8 in a row. And San Francisco is brutally tough in the series. It's brutally tough in the playoffs. But I like Kansas City in 7.
Kansas City, here I come. All right, one more minute. Go for it. You got something?
Yeah, just a little quick thing. I'm kind of laughing. Apparently, Mark Trestman has come up to defend Brendan Marshall. And after a really embarrassing, uninspired loss to Miami, where the Bears, who we all thought offensively really extraordinarily talented, top 10 wideouts in Marshall and Alshon Jeffrey, top 5 running back in Matt Forte, Martellus Bennett. You know, the key was this was the year that Jay Cutler was going to make the jump. And you know what? It didn't happen. And Marshall called him out, as he should have. And Mark Trestman went back to defend him. Defended him. And saying that Marshall didn't single out Cutler, we all know he did. And you know what? He's the leader. He deserves it. For Sean Palmer, this is Seth Kamens, Back Sports Page, the NBA preview next week. Have a good week, everybody.
Kansas City. Kansas City, here I come.